to read Back to Reality, the best-selling novel of the Bestseller Experiment by the two Marks, go to bestsellerexperiment.com/back to reality.
And subscribe to this podcast to get loads of extra bonuses. Go to bestsellerexperiment.com/subscribe. Let's run the show.
Hello and welcome to the Bestseller Experiment, where we continue to discover what makes a best-selling novel. I'm Mark Stay, and before we jump into this week's episode, I want to give a big shout out to our chums at Scrivener. Scrivener is the official writing app of the Bestseller Experiment. It's the app that Mr. DeVoe and I use to write our best-selling Kindle book, Back to Reality, and it can be yours, dear listener, for a chunky 20% off. Just pop over to literatureandlatte.com, put in the code BESTSELLERXP, that code again, BESTSELLERXP, and you will receive your discount. Just to give you an idea of how much I've fallen in love with Scrivener, the project I'm currently working on at the moment, I originally started a couple of years ago in Pages, which was my default writing app of choice, and I'm now imported it over into Scrivener, because there's something about the mindset of Scrivener. Once you get used to seeing all those lovely little chapters and having all your research in the one place, it really does make a big difference. So it's pretty much all I can work with now. Now, I'm speaking to you, dear listener, from a secret location in the Alps, somewhere between the Swiss and French border, and I'm here on a writing retreat. It's a retreat called Le Chant de la Cascade, which means the song of the waterfall, because there's a waterfall just up the road here, and it's run by the wonderful Marcus Sedgwick, award-winning children's author, and someone I admire very, very much. We're going to have a proper full episode talking about that, and that will also feature a podcast first for the Bestseller Experiment, an interview done from the confines of a hot tub. Yes, our first hot tub interview, and hopefully the first of many. It was done in the depths of night here, with strange animals making strange noises all around us in the dark, but Marcus and I soldiered on and got a very good interview out of that. So subscribe if you haven't already to check that out. Now, this week's episode is all about YALC. YALC is the Young Adult Literature Convention, part of the London Film and Comic Con. It takes place every July at London Olympia. And just to give you a flavour of it, I asked people why they were there.
To meet loads of authors, to learn about how to get published, to buy loads of books, hopefully win some proofs, meet loads of people that are bookish.
Getting to know all the authors that I love and that have inspired me to write myself. It's a great place to meet them all, and it's a really big atmosphere, really good atmosphere. So, yeah.
I actually really like seeing the amount of people here, the community. Like, it's the biggest book event I've ever been to, and it brings like all types of people together over things they love, and that's what I really like about it.
I'm just a really avid reader. I read all the time, a book a day. So it's just,
a book a day?
A lot of the time, a book a day, yeah. So that's why I've moved mainly to e-books, because they're cheaper to buy than a main book if I'm going through a book a day. But for an event like this, I'm quite happy to buy a book to get it signed by some of my favourite authors.
Yeah, a book a day. Can you believe it? And that's the kind of people who go to YALC. You know, you go to, if you heard our live show last week, you heard Marcus and Stevie talking about how people go to Comic Cons mainly to meet movie stars or what have you, or to, and of course the London Film Comic Con downstairs is very much that, people signing up to get autographs and photos and merchandise and memorabilia. But YALC is all about the books. And I've been there a few times now, and the passion, the readers, you know, they're so passionate about what they read, and they are going around with little wheelie bags full of books, spending lots of money on books. YALC has just celebrated 5 years. It was launched by Mallory Blackman when she was Children's Laureate and the Book Trust in 2013. It's now run by Showmasters, who do the London Film and Comic Con. Ticket sales were up 11% this year, and you had authors like Juno Dawson, Giovanna and Tom Fletcher. Tom Fletcher, of course, was in McFly, Becky Chambers, and many, many more. And they have panels, and things like Women's Vote and Writing with Political Intent. There's workshops on how to get published, submission letters, meeting agents, careers in publishing. So many people who go, they're not just passionate readers, they're also passionate writers as well. So you go there to meet authors, get a sense of community, and they're all voracious readers. It's interesting, YA is a much misunderstood category. First of all, YA is not a genre. It's not a genre. It's a category. I think if we had a Venn diagram, it would overlap both teen fiction and adult fiction, and within that category you'll find all genres. You'll find science fiction, fantasy, horror, mystery, literary fiction, non-fiction. And, you know, to be fair, these kinds of books have always existed. You go back and you look at stuff like Catcher in the Rye, The Outsiders, Go Ask Alice. Arguably, the current boom started with the Harry Potter books. Not necessarily the first three, which were very much middle grade, but from The Goblet of Fire onwards, the books began to deal with more complex issues and tonally became a lot darker. And then along came The Hunger Games and Twilight. What publishers began to realize was the readers of these books went well beyond their teens. There was a research recently taken by Hachette that shows that readers continue to read YA well into their mid-30s. And if you look at the charts, the current bestsellers, there's a lot of YA out there. There's To All the Boys I've Loved Before, which by Jenny Han, which is one of the biggest things on Netflix. Children of Blood and Bone by Tomi Adeyemi. Simon vs. the Homo Sapiens Agenda by Beggy Abatali, which is made into the movie Love, Simon. The Hate You Give by Angie Thomas is a movie of that coming soon. And what they all share, I think, is, you know, they're socially conscious. They have common themes of love, inclusion, diversity, identity, coming of age, gender. But they're all written in these great page-turning genres. They tackle difficult subjects, but are really entertaining. And it's this combination that makes them so popular. And I was really lucky to meet one of the best authors of this kind of book, Donyell Clayton. Donyell Clayton is a co-author of the Tiny Pretty Things series. She grew up in Washington, D.C., in the suburbs in Maryland. And she, like many, she's your classic kind of YA reader in that she was a voracious reader, read an awful lot. She's written a book called The Bells, which is the first in a YA series, which is all about beauty. And we talk about it in our conversation and how it started with an overheard conversation. She also gives us tips on well-building and YA, how to take a protagonist who might be unsympathetic and make them compelling. We talk about diversity, representation, default white. We talk about how every kid can be the hero of their own story. We talk about cultural appropriation, sensitivity reads, and why places like London and New York are places full of weirdos and why we should celebrate that. So let's listen to that now. Donyell, welcome to the Bestseller Experiment. How are you today?
Very good, thank you. So excited to be here.
You've been traveling all over the world. Where have you been recently?
Oh, my goodness. I was on tour in June, mostly in the boring United States. But now now I'm over here and I'm excited to go to Dublin and Scotland and go all over England.
See, it's not the boring United States. See, when I was a kid, United States was the A-team. It was Hollywood. It was movie. So, you know, it's... No, you're shaking.
It's trash now. So.
They might not let you back in now.
That's okay. Please. I'd rather stay here.
Well, here at the moment is YAOC, the YA Literary Convention, which is an amazing thing. It grows year on year. This year, attendances are like 11% up. It's an amazing event. Is this your first YAOC?
It is my first YAOC, and I'm very, I didn't know how to pronounce it, and I'm super excited. The energy is really great. Everyone's laughing and having fun, so it's a great crowd.
It is a great, it's kind of, I've been to quite a few conventions, but none of them are quite like YAOC, but they, all of the conventions have the similar thing where it's like a safe space. You can be who you want to be. Is that, that's right?
It's full of weirdos, and I love weirdos. That's why I like to live in cities where there are weirdos, so London, New York, Paris. And so this is a convention of all my friends and family, basically. It feels like home.
Let's talk about The Bells. Yes. Now, as I understand it, this book came about because of an overheard conversation. Is that correct?
Yes. I was about 12 or 13, and I was at one of those American suburban malls that you see on TV, and I heard these men talking about their wives and girlfriends and about which body parts they wish they had, like if she could only have this model's hair or this model's legs. And I thought, is this how men talk about women? And it broke something in me, and I wanted to create a world where, what if you could change yourself down to your bones? What choices would you make? And what if your partner wanted you to change certain things? You could do that. And would you do it? And what would that look like?
Especially when you're 12 or 13 as well. It's a vulnerable age for anyone, particularly a young woman. I mean, it's taken you this long to write the book. Has this been bubbling away in all that time? How did you start writing it?
It's been tough because, yes, it has been bubbling around, and because talking about bodies is so stressful and so anxiety-ridden and personal, it took me a long time to get it right. I rewrote the book 4 times from the beginning. It took about 5 years to sort of publish and to get right, but I wanted to take the time because it's so important to talk to 12 and 13 year olds and teens about what they're willing to do to their bodies in order to subscribe to this idea of perfection, or what is beauty anyway?
When you make a change like that to a society in a science fiction or fantasy era, it kicks off this whole thing of world building. How much of that world building did you have to do? Was that part of the drafting process?
Yes. So I did something that one of my good friends told me to do, Scott Westerfeld. He is wonderful. He said to answer the question, what in the world does everyone want? And then wrap your world sort of around that. And so that's how I built the Bells. And my world building started from that essential question. And I wanted to be in conversation with him because his series, Uglies, is one of my formative texts. And I wanted to build out from there. And what does everyone want? What are they willing to do to get it? What does it look like when they get it? What does it look like when it's taken away? And so I went down a rabbit hole of questions. And that's sort of how I world build.
It's a fantastic way of doing it. And into this, you bring your characters, including Camelia Beauregard. Tell us about her.
She's a naive, sort of spoiled girl who was told a certain thing about the world, and then now it's sort of blowing up. And I felt like that was my teenagehood. I grew up very spoiled, privileged in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., riding horses and sort of playing with dolls and sort of shepherded away from all of the evils of the world. And then when I started exploring, I realized that, oh, my parents wanted me in a bubble. And then when that bubble popped, I had to figure out, whoa, is this what the world is really like? And I had to find my armor. And so I wanted to sort of show a girl who was put on a pedestal, and then what happens when you fall? And what does that look like as you figure out how to get yourself back up again? There are a lot of fantasies that I love that usually follow the plucky thief or the rags to riches, but I wanted to start at the top and have a girl fall and see what we came up with. Try something different.
That's fantastic. I think particularly with that kind of character, if you want to sympathize with someone who's in a position of privilege, you really need to torture them, don't you? You really need to put them through hell. Tell us how you torture her.
Well, buckets of hot water and you drown them. So you find out that they think that they are in control of, making everyone in this world beautiful, and they are. But it's also forced labor. And all of the things that they've been training for, all the things that they've been told, all of the ways that they've been sort of charged as these instruments, these divine beings of beauty, is a lie. And they are there to work. And they are there at the beck and call of these people. So her bubble gets popped pretty fast. Which is mean and evil, but it must be done. And it happened to me as a teen.
Well, let's talk about that, because you're not many kids will have that kind of self-realization, frankly. Was this because of stuff that you said you were at the informative text? Were there books that you were reading that were a big influence on this?
Yes. So I was a bookworm. I was reading 3 or 4 books a week. My dad took me to the bookstore every Saturday to get a new book. I went to the library constantly. And as I started moving away from sort of like the candy books. I was a librarian. I call them candy books because they are sweet and wonderful, like Sweet Valley High and even sort of like R.L. Stine and Fear Street, these sort of fun books. I started getting these texts that were digging into real life issues. I remember when I first started reading about the Holocaust, I was like, what is this? This happened. I remember before I learned about it in school, I started opening up all of sort of the horrors of the world, and they were sort of laid bare for me in fiction, which was a great first introduction. But as a spoiled sort of privileged kid in a bubble, I was just so shocked that I was like, this is real? And my parents had to sit down and say, well, you're reading fiction, but it's drawn from real things that happened. So slowly but surely, I was learning about how men treat women, and how when you navigate this world through certain bodies, you are treated in different ways. So slowly, my worldview started opening up in ways that fiction helped me cope with the world.
And were you writing at that point?
No, I started writing late. I wanted to be a doctor. And then I failed chemistry when I was at university. And my parents were like, well, you need to figure it out. Figure out something else. And so I started reading the stuff that I loved as a kid. So The Hobbit, Harriet the Spy, A Wrinkle in Time, The Phantom Tollbooth. I wanted to go back to that. I was homesick and away, again, spoiled. I was like, I have to live with all these people and my mom's not here to cook and I have to do my laundry. And I was like having a crisis. So I started reading the things that I read as a child. And I thought, I want to be a teacher. I want to be a librarian. I want to teach children how to love to fall into books the way that I do and the way that I did as a kid reader. And then I got my master's in children's literature. And that's when they forced me to take a writing class because I had to in order to graduate and with my master's. And I fell in love with it. And I looked at the canon of children's books, all the books that I loved, and I realized that there were so many kids missing. And then I looked at the books that I loved reading as a kid and I said, whoa, I didn't get a chance to see kids like myself enough. And I thought, I need to write into that and make sure that every kid can be the hero of their own story. So that's how I sort of roundabout got to this writing thing.
Yeah. I mean, just this week, there was a report, I think it was from the Publishers Association or something like that, saying, particularly in YA, which always is so progressive, but even in YA, there's something like 1% of protagonists or just characters are people of color, which is shocking to me, even now, you know. What do we do?
Well, I was like, do I need to move over here and do We Need Diverse Books, England edition? Yes, I saw the report that came out that said 1% of books in the UK feature BAME? Character. I think that we have to give opportunities to writers from those communities to write themselves. We are sort of told when we look at popular culture that our stories don't matter and that they're not important and that we are not the heroes of stories. And so the more we can model that, and so that you can have some people from here do it too. I know that we're importing a lot of Americans, me being an import. Please rescue me. I would like to be imported. I'd like to immigrate. But
things aren't so great here at the moment either.
But you don't have an orange monster. So I would like to escape the orange monster and come here. But I think that we have to also show kids that they can be writers. You cannot be what you can't see. So when writers come to schools and talk about what they do, they need to see people who look like them. They need to also see people who look like them in picture books, in the texts that teach them how to read. They need to see their faces. They need to see that they can be full of magic, that they can go to outer space. They can go to Hogwarts. They can go through the closet and go into Narnia. They need to see all of those things.
There's a thing, because I'm a screenwriter as well, and there's a thing that happens in screenwriting, which they call default white, which is where if you have a cop or someone in the shop, someone behind the bar, just those characters, those day player kind of characters as well, there's this terrible thing where unless you state so in the script itself, people just assume that they're white. So there's a conversation going on in the scriptwriting world at the moment where we're saying, no, look, think about these things. You know, put people of color in there, put women in there, make the cop a woman, something as simple as that. It's not going to change overnight, but it gets people thinking. And that's what we need to do, really, isn't it?
Yes. Also, you just have to describe everyone. There is no default. You have to tell people what they look like. You're building a fictional universe. So tell people about who lives there and use specific and really good details. No one gets to be default because we are all here together. And I think we need something called incidental and casual diversity, where why can't that cop be a black female? Why not? It doesn't matter. It's a role. Also, we have to start infusing all of our work, because we're in this together, with diversity so that we see each other. That's how we learn about the world. Some of our first introductions to each other, like for me, were through texts and through books. So if I'm reading books where there are no characters that are Muslim or no characters that are LGBT, sometimes it might be the first introduction you have. And why not use this magical place that is reading to make a great introduction? Screenplays are a great place to start using this. Label everyone. Be specific, because why not?
One of the things, speaking as a privileged white man, that I'm very concerned about is cultural appropriation, where if I'm putting a character and putting a voice in that character and I'm getting it wrong, as I'm almost inevitably will. What advice do you have for writers like that who are maybe thinking, should I do this? Am I going to get this wrong? What should they be looking at? Because I know a friend of mine, Paul Cornell, he's had sensitivity reads for some of his books. Would you advise having those?
Yes, I'm a sensitivity reader. And so if you Google me, you'll see lots of things about sensitivity reads. I hate that term because it's not about being sensitive. It's really about craft. And it's about, I'm an editor. I edit for a specific thing. If you are going to write outside of yourself, I mean, writing is a conversation with ourselves and with each other. You have to do the work. It's a craft issue. So you have to ask the questions, you have to do the research, and you don't know what you don't know. So you have to go seek out the answers to those questions. One of my favorite writers, Jacqueline Woodson, who's wonderful, told me that if you're going to write about her community, which is my community, I want to feel like you are in my grandmother's kitchen, that you have held the babies, that you know those smells, that you are sitting at the table. If not, don't do it. If you can't do that, if you can't do that level of work, stay in your lane and then populate your lane and your world with other characters that are periphery, so that then you can do the level of research that you're at. But it's a craft issue is what it is. And we are at a crisis point in our industry where we need to start prioritizing people writing from inside of their own communities so that those numbers go up and so that kids can see other people as writers and say, hey, I want to do that. And then we also as creators have to make sure that our worlds reflect the actual world. And when you live in London and you live in New York like me, it's a place full of weirdos. And the weirdos come in all different colors and shapes and sizes. And that's what's so wonderful about it.
Absolutely. What's next for you?
The second book in the Bells comes out in March of next year. It's called The Everlasting Rose. And then I have another book called The Rumor Game with my writing partner, Sona Charapatra. Follows three girls and the destructive path of a rumor in high school. Yes, and lots of other fun projects. But right for now, I'm just trying to get myself together and stop being a natural disaster in terms of writing. Get on top of my deadlines, you know, all the stuff that writers do.
Thank you so much for speaking to me. Enjoy the rest of the convention. You've got panels and signings late today. Have a great time. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Huge thanks to Danielle for speaking to me at Yauk. Seriously, her queue afterwards, the line for her signing, she was there for 2 hours, seriously, because I watched the whole thing. I was on the Gallant store, and her queue just went on and on and on, and she spoke to everyone, and she's incredible. So, do check out The Bells from Danielle Clayton and new book coming soon. A big thanks to everyone who's got in touch with us via social media. We've got a couple of public declarations, one of them kind of late, but it's from Poppy T. Perry on Twitter. Poppy, I spoke to at the children's convention last year, and she's a fantastic children's writer, and she says, look, this is the face of a winner. Feeling very poorly and tired this morning, but it made it out of bed to write for 5 a.m. My self-set deadline of the end of September is fast approaching. Forgot to tell Bestseller XP about it as a public declaration. Poppy, that's kind of missing the point. You have to tell us before the deadline comes up. But good luck. Really hope you make it. Please tell us if you do. Now, Andy Robinson, who is at The Forewarning on Twitter, he's already given us a declaration for NaNoWriMo. He said, the podcast version of underlining my tweet declaring my intention to write a screenplay during NaNoWriMo was read out during this week's episode. I've also roped in fellow screenwriter at @DanL_Tetley, who is going to attempt this madness as well. Pray for us. Good luck, guys. And this goes to anyone out there. If you're intending to do something for NaNoWriMo, first of all, check out our NaNoWriMo episodes. They would definitely help. And do let us know. Make a public declaration. It makes all the difference. Now, a few episodes ago, we spoke to the wonderful Pernilla Hughes, whose debut novel, Sweatpants at Tiffany's, is out there and getting rave reviews. She put a lovely video up on Facebook, and we'll put a link to this in the show notes, of her unboxing her book for the first time, the paperback edition of a book. And she calls it a book, a box of dream come true, which is such a lovely way of putting it. So congratulations on that, Pernilla. And we hope it continues to be a smash hit.
We've had a tweet from S.E. Moorhead. No, I finished binge listening the Bestseller Experiment podcast. I'm now bereft. What am I going to do when I walk my dog Seamus? Heads over to Patreon for deep dives. Now, a big shout out to some of our new Patreon supporters, not least Kit Grant, who's just signed up. Thank you very much, Kit. And Ruth Fitzgerald, who upped her pledge. This is it. We have different levels of pledge. If you want to help us out, and seriously, we cannot do this podcast without you. It's patreon.com/bestseller experiment. And that's it for this week. Thanks for listening. Do get in touch on social media. Facebook is Bestseller Experiment. Twitter is at Bestseller XP, as is Instagram. Don't forget to sign up to our mailing list. You get the free ebook, The Vault of Gold, which is transcripts from our first year of interviews featuring amazing authors, including Joe Hill, Sarah Pimbra, Michael Connolly, and lots more. And buy our book, Back to Reality. I am working on the paperback of that, I swear. It will be coming soon, so stay tuned for that. And so thanks for joining us. And until next time, happy writing.